From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on This Day in Maine, Friday, October 31st, 2025. Open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act's online marketplace begins tomorrow, and some Mainers could face steep premium increases if Congress doesn't act. Enhanced premium tax credits that make plans more affordable will expire at the end of the year, but they're also at the center of the government shutdown fight. Chyna Immel of South Portland says she relies on the ACA for health insurance after leaving a corporate job because of serious health issues.
I just want them to think about the real impact this has on the lives that they don't see, and just because they can close their eyes and walk away from it and feel comfortable with all the money that they have, just think about what you're doing to the rest of us.
Congressional Democrats want to extend enhanced premium tax credits as part of a deal to end the shutdown. Republicans say they want to negotiate the tax credits only after reopening the government. The Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention has identified a 30th HIV case in the Penobscot County outbreak. The agency first identified the outbreak 2 years ago, and this is the fifth case confirmed since June. It says the majority of patients in the outbreak have experienced homelessness in the last year and have used injection drugs in the last year. All but one of the patients were also diagnosed with a hepatitis C co-infection. A Cumberland County jury has sided with a Maine woman who alleged that a Midcoast area health facility was negligent in its treatment of her teenage daughter and partially responsible for her death. In her wrongful death lawsuit, Lindsay Sutherland alleged that doctors at the Midcoast Medical Group failed to perform basic tests that would have revealed her daughter's serious but treatable form of cancer. The jury awarded Sutherland $25 million in damages. Her attorney, Merrill Poulin, says she hopes the verdict will bring Sutherland peace and closure.
I also hope that it will send a clear message that Maine juries are willing to hold medical providers accountable when they fail to meet minimum standards of care.
An attorney representing Midcoast Medical Group declined to comment for this story. The mayors of Portland and Biddeford today called for a special legislative session to release more funding to support the 170,000 Mainers who could lose their SNAP benefits because of the government shutdown. Portland Mayor Mark Dion says the $1.25 million Governor Janet Mills has pledged is not enough to replace funding for the 9,000 SNAP recipients in his city alone. He says the state should tap into its so-called rainy day fund to provide more relief.
You have $1 billion in the bank. That's our money. Let me be clear. That's our money, and our residents deserve it.
Mills says the rainy day fund cannot legally be used for short-term SNAP funding. A federal judge in Rhode Island Friday ruled that the federal government must use contingency funds to continue SNAP benefit payments during the shutdown, quote, as soon as possible. It's unclear what that will mean for recipients. The Maine Human Rights Commission this week sided with a former employee who has accused the Roman Catholic Diocese of Portland of age discrimination. The commission voted unanimously that there are reasonable grounds to believe the diocese discriminated against Reverend Monica Giordano, who worked for nearly 20 years as an administrative assistant in the Ellsworth Parish. In 2023, Giordano was disciplined and then terminated by the diocese. She was 72 years old at the time. Kristen Aiello represented Giordano before the commission.
My client was a qualified, longstanding employee who was exercising her right as a 72-year-old employee in the workplace to exist without being harassed, demeaned, and threatened because of her age.
In a statement, the diocese expressed disappointment in the vote and notes that a finding of reasonable grounds does not necessarily mean the commission believes Giordano will prevail at trial. The case now moves into a conciliation process before the commission. If a settlement is not reached, Giordano has the right to pursue the claim in court. According to a new assessment issued by the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank lobster stock has declined 34% since its peak in 2018, and is now approaching levels last seen around 15 years ago. For the first time, regulators have also determined that overfishing is occurring, meaning the amount of lobsters being removed from the stock is just past the threshold of what scientists consider to be sustainable, but that did not trigger immediate regulatory action. Tracy Pugh is a fisheries biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries and the chair of the commission's technical committee.
Now is the time to start having the conversations about what are our tools, what are our goals here, what do we want this to look like, and how do we get there?
In light of the new data, the Fisheries Commission is recommending that the Lobster Board reevaluate its management strategies to prevent further declines. Deer season starts this weekend, and many hunters will be heading into the woods with bullets made of lead. Decades after the U.S. removed the toxic metal from gasoline, paint, and water pipes, it's still the most common form of ammo on the market. And toxic lead debris can taint wild game meat and poison wildlife, such as bald eagles. As Peter McGuire reports, state wildlife officials are ramping up efforts to convince hunters to switch to non-toxic bullets and curb one of the last sources of lead contamination in the environment. A warning to listeners, this story does include sound of gunfire.
All right, I'm going hot.
Yeah, I want hot.
Tim Summers peers through his scope and gets ready to squeeze off a shot. He's at the Scarborough Fish and Game Association shooting range, preparing for the start of deer hunting season.
It's on the target that would have killed deer.
Like a lot of hunters, Summers uses lead bullets coated with a thin copper jacket. And as someone who cares about wildlife and who eats the meat from the animals he kills, he says he's aware that lead bullets can pose a problem.
You think about it, it's a little pellet at the end of the day of lead. You know, if that shatters and gets into the meat and stuff of an animal, then, you know, you could be ingesting quite a bit of it, I guess.
Summers says he's never tried lead-free bullets. He's still got a store of cartridges to get through, but he's open to the idea.
Honestly, I haven't been looking too hard for it, but, I might try it. Might try it this season. I don't know.
Summers is the kind of hunter that Maine wildlife officials believe they can convince to make the switch to solid copper bullets.
Many hunters have already tried it or are using it, and the majority of those that haven't are open to the idea. And so that's a pretty good place to be.
Nate Webb is with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. He says that when an animal is shot with traditional lead ammo, the bullet shatters, releasing hundreds of tiny fragments into the flesh. And those toxic slivers can sicken or kill scavengers looking for a meal.
There also has been some research that, you know, suggests there could be health concerns for people that consume a lot of wildlife that's harvested with lead-based ammunition. That research is a little bit more debatable, I would say.
Webb's department uses social media, live demonstrations, and hunting license information to promote alternative ammunition. 30% of Maine hunters said they were extremely or very likely to use non-lead bullets in a 2022 survey. But the perceived cost and availability of copper bullets is a barrier. Webb says actually non-lead bullets cost about the same and are increasingly easy to find on store shelves.
There's been effort to reduce the amount of lead in the environment, and particularly the human sort of food chain, for many years. And this is kind of one of the last areas where there still is lead going into the environment.
At Avian Haven in Freedom, it's feeding time at the Bald Eagle enclosure. Executive Director Barbara Haney says staff at the rehabilitation nonprofit assume that any eagle that comes in has lead poisoning.
What we're looking at is about 75% of all of the bald eagles that we've had have evidence of lead. So that's a lot. That actually corresponds with the statistics that we're getting from other rehab centers as well.
Sick birds are so weak they can't hold their heads or wings up. They're confused and unfocused. Some live, but others are too far gone. Haney says lead bullets are the only source of that contamination. And for eagles, eating a piece of lead the size of a grain of rice can be fatal.
If we can do a simple thing like cut back on the amount of lead that's in the environment, it's going to make a huge impact on our wildlife.
Back at the Scarborough Gun Range, Charlie Largay supervises the rifle sighting event. Largay has hunted and shot competitively his whole life, and these days he uses only copper ammo.
It's just as accurate, if not more so, and it doesn't leave the residue behind. I mean, we don't need the woods full of lead.
There's a precedent for this kind of phase-out. It's been against federal law to hunt ducks and geese with lead shot since the early 1990s, and it is increasingly hard to buy lead fishing tackle. Advocates aren't trying to eliminate lead ammo completely. Largay says it's fine to use for target shooting, for example. And he says out in the field, hunters aren't shooting a lot of rounds anyway.
Typically, if you're a deer hunter or you're hunting most game, you're going to get one shot.
And Largay says there's no need for that bullet to contain lead. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Peter McGuire.
And now it's time for Maine's Political Pulse. I'm joined by Maine Public Statehouse correspondent Kevin Miller. Next week, voters will decide two issues that have been debated in Maine for years, even decades. Question one proposes a voter ID law and would change Maine's absentee voting process, while question two deals with a red flag gun law. Kevin, it seems like the referendum has been overshadowed by the primary battle between Governor Janet Mills and Graham Plattner, even though that election is still 8 months away, and of course, by the nonstop political news out of Washington. So let's start with a quick primer on these ballot initiatives. Tell us about question one.
Well, question one has two parts. The first would require all voters to show a photo ID in order to cast a ballot starting next year. And question one would also make multiple changes to Maine's absentee voting process, including eliminating 2 days of absentee balloting.
Okay, now give us a quick overview of question two, and then we'll get into more specifics on each measure.
Right, so question two proposes what's known as a red flag gun law. This would allow family members or members of a household to go directly to a judge to ask them to order someone to temporarily give up their guns if they're suicidal or if they could pose a threat to other people.
So circling back to question one, this is a pretty complicated proposal. Can you break it down a bit? Like, what are the big changes that the groups behind question one are pushing for?
Sure. So let's start with the simpler part, the voter ID provisions. Basically, if this passes, starting next year, you'd have to produce a driver's license or a passport, a military ID, or a state-issued non-driver's ID in order to cast a ballot. And then if you're requesting an absentee ballot, you'd have to provide your driver's license number or a photocopy of that ID to your clerk.
And then how about the absentee balloting parts of that question?
Yeah, so this is where things get more complicated. We don't have time to get into all of them right now, but I can highlight some of the biggest changes. First, it would eliminate 2 days of absentee balloting. It would also eliminate the option of having towns automatically send out absentee ballots to certain voters for every election, so they wouldn't have to request one year after year. Under question one, voters would also no longer be allowed to request absentee ballots over the phone or for an immediate family member. And if question one passes, towns would be limited to one drop box for absentee ballots.
So it sounds like there are some kind of competing narratives around what question one would actually do.
It almost seems like the two sides are talking about two completely different initiatives. Supporters have been focused largely on the voter ID provisions because these laws tend to have bipartisan support, and they say it reduces the likelihood of voter fraud. But opponents have just been hammering the absentee balloting changes. They say this will disenfranchise potentially tens of thousands of voters, and especially the elderly, the disabled, and minority groups.
And what do we know about the groups that are heavily involved in the campaigns on both sides of this question?
So the petition drive to get question one on the ballot was led by a conservative political action committee called Dinner Table Action and its sister group For Our Future. And the Voter ID for Maine campaign has received almost all of its money from a national PAC called the Republican State Leadership Committee. The opposition, meanwhile, has been led by a group called Save Maine Absentee Voting. This is a coalition of more than 30 groups, ranging from the League of Women Voters and Maine People's Alliance to the AFL-CIO Labor Union and the Wabanaki Alliance. And they've also received a lot of financial support from national groups, like the National Education Association and other labor unions.
All right, so that's question one. Now let's turn to question two. This one proposes what's called a red flag gun law in Maine, but the state already has a yellow flag law. Can you explain the difference here?
Yeah, that's right. So Maine's yellow flag law has been on the books since 2020. It wasn't used much before the Lewiston mass shootings 2 years ago, but since then, it's been used more than once a day on average. The big differences between a red flag and a yellow flag law are basically who can initiate the process and then what has to happen before someone can be forced to surrender their guns. So under Maine's current yellow flag law, only police can go to a judge to start that process. The law then also requires that a healthcare professional evaluate the person, and then they have to agree that they pose a threat before a judge can issue the order. Under the red flag proposal, on the other hand, family members could go straight to a judge. They wouldn't have to involve police at all. And then there's no mandatory mental health evaluation as part of question two.
And so what would happen to the yellow flag law if voters pass question two?
That's been a big part of this debate. Both laws would stay on the books. Supporters of question two say it merely gives families an additional option. But opponents argue that the red flag law would dramatically undercut the current law. They basically ask, why would police or anyone else go through the additional steps that are required under the yellow flag law if they can red flag someone? And they say those steps are what makes Maine's law so much better than the nearly two dozen red flag laws in other states, because it adds that extra layer of due process to the targeted individual.
And then who are the groups behind the yes and no campaigns on question two?
The Maine Gun Safety Coalition and its allies got question two on the ballot because they say the Lewiston mass shootings prove that the yellow flag law is inadequate because it could have been used, but it wasn't. The opposition has been led by the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, Gun Owners of Maine, and several smaller allied groups. And the No on Two campaign has also received very prominent support from Governor Janet Mills, who helped to negotiate the yellow flag law, and from law enforcement groups.
That was Maine Public Statehouse correspondent Kevin Miller. You can find more coverage of these two ballot questions on our website at mainepublic.org/pulse. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Join us tomorrow morning at 8 for Weekend Edition on Maine Public Radio. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.